Cancer can take away all my physical abilities. It cannot touch my mind, it cannot touch my heart, and it cannot touch my soul. And those three things are going to carry on forever.
Hey everyone, I'm Mick McDonald, and we're so glad you're back with us on the V Foundation for Cancer Researchers Voices for Victory podcast. Each episode, we'll speak with folks who've been touched by cancer in some way, or are leading cutting-edge cancer research. And sometimes both. In Jim's famous ESPY speech, he said there are three things in life that are most important to him: where you started, where you are, and where you're going to be. We want to hear from many different voices about why it's so important that we achieve victory over cancer. Today, our guest is Scott Hamilton. Scott's an Olympic gold medal winning figure skater, accomplished author, and a three-time cancer survivor. Scott's incredible life story is inspiring, and today, we chat with him about how the trials and tribulations from early in his life helped power him through his cancer diagnoses later on. We also discuss his work as an outspoken activist supporting cancer research and how focusing on the positive can get you through some dark times. And now, our conversation with Scott Hamilton.
And I always have to think about what's important in life is to think to me of three things: where you started, where you are, and where you're going to be. Those are the three things that I try and do every day.
And we are so lucky to be joined on the Voices for Victory podcast today by the one and only Scott Hamilton. Scott, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to sit down and talk with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's an honor to talk to you, Mick.
So, Scott, I want to start. We're going to kind of walk through here. You've had, and I think people know a lot of your life story, but maybe not all of it. And it is just one of the most incredible stories that I've ever heard. So I'd love to start. Aww. It's really inspiring and motivating, I think, to a lot of people. So I'd love to start. You know, people know about you're an Olympic gold medal winning skater, and, you know, certainly your personal battles with cancer, I think people are pretty aware of, thanks to all the great work you've done being an advocate. But even before all of that, you know, when you were very young, you had some really scary stuff to deal with health-wise as a young kid. So can you kind of walk us through kind of how, you know, you jumped right into life with some tough health issues you had to deal with when you were very young?
It was kind of, you know, it's really weird. Looking back on all of it, it just seems so choreographed now, you know. But back then, you know, I was adopted at 6 weeks of age. You know, my parents really wanted to have a big family, but, you know, it just wasn't meant to be for them to create a family. So they started the adoption process. So I was their first adopted child, and things were great. You know, I was active, and I loved my life, and loved my parents, loved my, you know, my house, loved everything. And I was a little crazy. I'd be climbing up on the roof at age 3 and things like that. You know, I had to be really careful. Well,
Scott, I've got a 2-year-old son, so you're putting ideas in my head for what he's going to be doing in a year.
Oh, no, it's real. You know, it's either they do it or they don't. But generally, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I would build forts in the cabinet above the refrigerator. You know, I was kind of fearless that way, and very active. I mean, I was just go, go, go all the time. And we lived in a neighborhood with a lot of kids my age, and we'd go out and play, and it was really fun. And by about age 4, they realized that there was something going on, something different, something they needed to pay attention to, because I basically stopped growing. And they didn't know because, you know, again, I was adopted, whether it was just genetics or whether, you know, they didn't know. So they kind of kept an eye on it. And I remember, you know, doing kind of healthy visits to the doctor. And then pretty soon I started showing some signs of stress. You know, I wasn't digesting my food properly. I wasn't, I'd start to get a little bit, you know, lack of energy and all these other things. So they decided to go, you know, get me tested for whatever could be wrong. And that turned into a 4-year adventure where we went from Wood County Memorial Hospital, our local hospital. They couldn't find anything. So we went to a bigger hospital, Toledo Children's Hospital. I was there for a while. They couldn't figure it out. Year 3, I went to Ann Arbor. I was there in and out. I would be living kind of in the hospital doing all these tests after test after test because I was very sick and they didn't really know what to do to help me. So it was in Ann Arbor that they thought I had cystic fibrosis, but I didn't test for it. They, you know, basically gave me 6 months to live. And my mother, you know, put a big smile on her face and said, well, we're going to be leaving now. Thank you for your time.
Right.
And then we ended up, you know, why not? My, you know, my mom and dad were from Massachusetts, and we had, you know, a place to stay with my grandparents. We went to kind of the granddaddy of them all, Boston Children's Hospital. And I had every symptom of a disease called Shwachman-Diamond syndrome. And I was being seen by Dr. Shwachman himself. And it was there. I was there for a long time. And it was very, it was a lot of stress. By now I was 8 years old, and I was really under a lot of stress. I had a very distended stomach. I had no muscle development. And, you know, they took me off dairy and sugar and white flour. And, you know, so birthday parties weren't a lot of fun. but then it just sort of, Dr. Shwachman, after, you know, that year, sat us down and he just said, hey, look, I thought he had Shwachman-Diamond syndrome. He has every symptom of it, but he doesn't. And, you know, it took me a while to prove it, but he doesn't have it. In fact, we don't know what's wrong with him. So what we recommend is for you to go home, take him off all the restrictive diets, because we could be starving him to death, and just live a normal life and see what happens next, and just, you know, live whatever your time is left, live it joyfully. So my parents, they went home, were exhausted from this 4-year ordeal. They had adopted another son. I like to call that insurance, but no, it was, they wanted a big family. And so they're looking after this, this baby, and I'm, you know, kind of like still active and not feeling well. And our family physician just came to my parents as kind of an intervention and said, you know, Ernie, Dorothy, you need a day off. You just need a day off to recharge your batteries. This has been extremely stressful for you. And so he recommended that I go to this brand new facility at Bowling Green State University, where from 8 a.m. until noon, they're teaching children how to ice skate. And I went with my sister, my family doctor's two daughters, we all went together. And I got there, and I never really got to spend that much time with that many well kids. There was over 100 kids in the program. And I just, you know, got on the ice, and it was something that I felt like I it was a challenge. And pretty soon I realized that I could skate as well as the well kids. And it was not long after that I realized that I was skating as well as the best athletes in my grade. And for the very first time in my life, self-esteem sort of rose to the surface, and it was really powerful. It was just amazing. So all I wanted to do was skate. And miraculously, I started growing, and I started, you know, kind of digesting my food again, and I was building muscle, and it was just sort of, you know, the timing of it was just sort of miraculous. You know, they still didn't have any answer to what kept me that sick for 4 years, but they found that now I am starting to get better. And they felt like it was, you know, if this is the only thing working, guess what? We're going to keep doing this. And, you know, no matter at, you know, what point financially, you know, it put my parents, you know, at risk. They just kept me in skating. And pretty soon I was, you know, training half a year in Illinois. I started to make it to the national championships. And then around my junior year in high school that my mom sat me down and just said, you know, we've got a problem here. You know, I've got cancer. But, you know, she was very joyful about it and very, you know, upbeat. And so I was like, okay, she doesn't seem too nervous about it. So if she's not scared, I'm not scared. And I, you know, I went about my business and found a way to win nationals, even though it was time for me to quit. The win at junior nationals allowed me to find a sponsor and a coach that was interested in teaching me. And so all of a sudden now I was in the game, you know, for a senior level competition. And my health was still great. And then my first year in senior men, I bombed. And because I wasn't trained. I was 18. I call it the trifecta. I was 18. I got my own apartment and I was sponsored. And I was a mess. I wasn't trained properly. I was distracted. I wasn't mature enough to kind of be accountable, all those things. And that competition would be the last time my mother would ever see me skate. And so out of her loss, she was basically, you know, I call her the center of my universe. When I lost her, I just had to kind of, that was it. I had to figure out, what am I going to do with this grief? And I decided to take that grief to the ice and be the skater and person she always thought I could be. And from there, results came quickly. I was third at nationals the next year, and then on the Olympic team in 1980, and then from 81, or actually the fall of 1980 to March of 84, I never lost a competition. And it was just sort of out of, you know, all these weird situations, you know, it's just what in the world just happened. You know, I'm this sick kid, shortest one in my class, bullied constantly. Really, there. I mean, what chance do I have? You know, all of it's so unlikely. To this day, I'm still processing, you know, how it all happened. But, you know, when I look back on the childhood illness, it kept me at a size where I could really be, effective in skating. You know, I had every muscle I ever built was on the ice, so I didn't have anything extra. all my physicality, all my athleticism, everything was built on the ice specifically for skating. So that was sort of an odd blessing. And then the fact that I grew and I started getting better, no one could explain until much, much later.
And I think that's part of why I really wanted you to tell that part of your story from early on, Scott, is because, like you said, it's just such an unlikely story. But you know, in a way that there was some silver linings or whatever you want to call it behind what you had to go through that maybe ended up benefiting you in some way long term. And I wonder if it's just simply that all you had to go through in the, you know, from when you were four or so to when you were eight and everything that you had to go through. I mean, do you think maybe that helped you deal with things that you had to then go through later in your life because you had dealt with such a large amount of, you know, adversity when you were so young?
I think the one major thing that I learned in those years of being in hospitals was, you know, children's hospitals back in the mid 60s aren't what they are today, meaning that, you know, it was a very sterile environment with a bed and a chair in the corner of the room for visitors. There wasn't a day bed like there is now. There wasn't, you know, toys and games and all those things. So my mom would, on those really scary nights, she would sleep in that chair. You know, she was exhausted, and, you know, and she would do that as often as she possibly could. And so I realized that, you know, and all the times that she couldn't be there because she, you know, she was working and she was raising a family and she was going to school, and she was an amazing woman. And the times that she couldn't be there, I learned at a very young age to be independent and self-sufficient. And I think, you know, that kind of allowed me to have a really unique perspective of, like, I can do this on my own. You know, I'm going to be okay, you know, on my own. And so when they kind of close the door behind you in these big competitions and you're by yourself on the ice, like, there was no real codependency with me. You know, it was like, okay, I got this. You know, I'm just going to go out and skate, you know, and see what happens. And in all of that, you know, again, just those those psychological muscles I learned of being on my own at a very young age allowed me to be on my own later on in life.
And it's clear how much your mom meant to you. I mean, I watched the TED Talk you gave last year, which is a great watch. I'd encourage anyone who hasn't seen it to go take a look. Very motivating speech that you gave there. I know those are hard to put together. So I thought it was very well said.
That one. That one. you know, I'm in Nashville. You know, I go to the BMI, the Songwriter Honors. I run into the guy that runs the TEDx Nashville, and he goes, "Hey, do you want to do a TED Talk for us?" And I go, "Sure. What would you like it on?" He goes, "Ah, anything you want." And it was, really? Because that's pretty broad.
Yeah.
And so I'm dedicated to my faith, you know, so every now and then I have these kind of thoughts that just sort of pop into my head, you know, and I know exactly where they come from, but it was suffering. And I go, "Ah, man, suffering's such a downer. Why do I want to talk about suffering?" So I went on the TED, you know, on the app and into the website, and I put suffering in for a search and it was like, there was never a talk on suffering. And it's like, how could no one talk about the one thing all people go through in life? How could nobody ever address that? I mean, there's these psychologists and major thinkers and philosophers. Why wouldn't anybody ever talk about suffering? You know, so I figured, okay, well, I have to do it, you know, in whatever way that I possibly can. And in that, you know, I learned a lot. You know, I was able to kind of tell my story and how with each time that I've had to endure something, there was something revealed on the other side that wouldn't have been possible without that period of suffering. And it was meant as a, you know, an encouragement, and it was meant to allow people to own, operate, and utilize their own suffering. But generally it was like, wow, I was able to kind of piece a lot of things together in that talk. And it was just sort of another one of those times where you can look at it as coincidence or God's scheduled opportunity.
And you pick. No question. Yeah. And one of the things that you mentioned in that talk was you talk a little bit about how your mom's death allowed you to find your greatest character and honor her, which mm-hmm. I just thought was a very kind of motivating thought for anyone who's lost someone that then kind of uses them as motivation to, whether it's, you know, for you, it was skating or whatever you're in, you know, how did you kind of take that? And it seems to me, just from having heard you speak a lot, is you were very good at taking the negative and kind of turning it into a positive. So how did you take that and say, this is going to motivate me to be successful in what my mom wanted me to do and what I want to do?
Well, it was the morning I lost her. You know, I was in her room until about 3:30 in the morning and she wasn't conscious. There was a lot of people visiting. You know, we lived in a very small house. And so I was sleeping on the couch in the family room, and my brother-in-law at the time, he woke me up and he just said, "Your mother is gone." And all I could think to say was, "I know." I mean, I didn't know how to acknowledge that. It was devastating. And, you know, as much as you know that, you know, there's no way she can survive this, you just aren't ever prepared for those words that, you know, she's gone. And so I got up from the couch and I got dressed and I walked around the backyard by myself for, I don't know, hours, you know, just thinking about her and thinking about all the times that I'd let her down and thinking about the times that, you know, that I didn't rise up to, you know, the opportunities that she sacrificed for me to have. And, you know, there was a friend of mine in school, and, you know, he suffered great loss. He lost his mom in a car accident, and he kind of anesthetized through alcohol. And I realized that, you know, that's not what my mom would want for me. You know, she would never want for me to, you know, hurt myself, you know, because she was no longer there. She'd want me something better for me than that. And so in that, you know, kind of negotiation with myself on that long walk, I realized that I'll just, you know, instead of feeling her missing, I can take her with me wherever I go. And so I bring her to the ice with me every day, and she would hold me accountable. It would be on those days that I didn't really want to be on time for a figures, you know, session. I would say, honor her. I'm going to do this right. And my work level, my accountability, my maturity sort of kicked into another level. And I realized that, that, you know, she was really powering this newfound character, discipline, accountability that I really never had when she was alive, you know? And so I, to this day, you know, I have a cancer foundation because, you know, I lost my mom to cancer and I survived cancer and what do I do with that? And how do I do this? I mean, how do I, you know, and so the best thing I could do is just, you know, honor her in every way I possibly could. And in that way, it filled basically the hole that was in my being that I lost the person in the world that I love the most.
And you mentioned, and I want to get to, you know, eventually, of course, you were diagnosed with cancer. When you got that first diagnosis, because obviously you've been through it several times, the first diagnosis, though, how hard was it to not just think, this is what took my mom, you know, how am I going to beat it? You know, what was the, walk me through kind of the thought process of, oh my gosh, this is, you know, I know not the same, but you know, you hear that cancer word and you obviously relate it to what your mom went through. How difficult was that for you when you first heard that?
Oh man, it was, I try to, you know, kind of turn everything into a little bit of a funny situation. You know, it's like whether I have a sense of humor, a sense of comedy, or no common sense. I don't really know. But, you know, when he said we found a mass, I kind of chuggled a little bit. And it's like, okay, I came here for an ulcer and you're talking to me about a mass. And he goes, what's so funny? And I said, well, nobody's ever used the word mass in description of me before. And he goes, no, you need to take this thing seriously. And I go, why? And he said, because it's either benign, malignant, or something else. And when I heard those words, benign or malignant, I realized all at once that I was being somewhat diagnosed with cancer. And I watched my mother and our family physician go through it. We lost our family doctor, the one that got me into skating. I lost him to cancer first. And I went to visit him in his hospital room, and he was hooked up to all these machines. And I saw that as me. And ironically, the room that my mother was in, her last night of life, was the exact same room that my family physician was in the same hospital. And so, you know, those images were so powerful, and the fear was beyond description. I mean, I just felt myself, you know, I just saw myself diminishing and suffering and all these pity party things you can have. And then, and then all of a sudden that really weird thought jumps in, oh, and I'll never skate again. It's like, wait, what's going on here? And I honestly, I don't know if it was 5 minutes or 5 seconds or a nanosecond. I really don't know. But in a moment, it just flicked. It went from this massive amount of crippling fear to this sense of, nope, I got this. I got this. I'm going to hit it with everything I've got. I'm going to be the best patient, I'm going to be, you know, present. I'm going to be involved. I'm going to do this thing, and I'm going to be right back here on tour next year. And that was it was like, where did that come from? Like, it was like, wham, instant, from just being devastated and fearful and just completely enveloped in just fear and suffering, to all of a sudden flip. And it was like an awakening, where now it's like, no, I'm in charge. Like, I'm going to fix this thing. I'm going to make this thing happen. I'm going to be the best patient they've ever had. And I'm going to be right back on tour next year. That was my goal instantly. And so, I had to do a show that night, which had its own levels of comedy, because I was being very dramatic. It's like, this is my last show ever. This could be my very last show ever. And, you know, it was just hysterical. There was one point where I was skating to this, you know, kind of bleeding heart ballad, you know, I started to get into character of this pity party. I'll never skate again. I'm going to die. And all these things sort of kind of crept in again. And I'm heading in to build speed for my hardest jump in the show, which was the hardest jump I ever did in competition. And I'm in character and I'm just feeling sorry for myself. But I look in the front row and there's this lady, you know, attractive lady sitting in the front row. And she was looking into a mirror, kind of fixing her powder on her nose and touching her hair and, you know, just sort of just looking after herself cosmetically. And it was like, I burst out laughing. It was like, I'm the only one that cares. this is like I'm in the middle of thinking that I'm in this world changing event of suffering through this disease, and it's like, and the world goes on, like life goes on for everybody else. And so I kind of started laughing, and it was I went into the jump, and I was almost weak from laughing inside, and I landed it on a very wobbly leg and got through the rest of the program. And the next morning I was in Cleveland getting a biopsy, and the next day they told me I had stage 3 testicular cancer.
And you know, I think that goes back to kind of, you know, back when your mom first passed, you said, you know, you kind of used her character to get through some tough times on, you know, on the ice when you were training and you're better. Did you kind of circle back to that off the ice now? Yeah. When you had to go back to this, it was like, hey, my mom got me through some tough times earlier. She's going to get me through these times again.
Yeah, she showed up, you know, like these memories flooded back. Like, just picture this. My mom was 5'1¼". She likes saying that she was 5'1¼". Like, you know, what's that, you know? And she always struggled with her weight. You know, I'd always joke that she was a 4x4. You know, she always carried more weight than she. And so she was a little self-conscious, and she was, you know, but always beloved. You know, she had a great sense of humor. She was very interactive. She was very thoughtful. She was very generous. She was very, you know, she would share her own suffering to help others kind of rise up to recognize that they have power in this moment. And she did some things when she was going through chemotherapy. She would say, like, oh, this chemotherapy, I finally found a way to lose all this weight. And it was like, oh, this chemotherapy, it's fantastic. I've wanted to quit smoking all these years. Now I have no desire whatsoever. And then she'd say, oh, this chemotherapy, I've always hated my hair. These wigs are so much easier. And I just thought, that's who I want to be. I want to be like that. I never even thought of that until they started hooking me up for chemotherapy. And it was like, she came back to me. And those memories were just really funny. And it was, you know, she owned and operated her cancer and all the chemotherapy that she went through. And so I at that moment, I kind of said, okay, here's my rules of engagement. Nobody is allowed in my space unless they make me laugh. And so in that way, it was like I was controlling my environment so that I would never look back on my cancer and feel like it was some sort of painful, you know, sick pity party. I wanted it to be one where I could look back on. I could remember when Doug and Lara Ledre and David Baden showed up in skinhead wigs, or people bring in Beaglepuss classes into my room, or my nurse, my oncology nurse, decorating my chemo bags with Snoopy stickers and Mylar. And she gave me SpongeBob and Scooby-Doo Band-Aids. And, you know, she treated me like a pediatric patient. I was 38 years old, you know. So, like, people got it, and they really wanted to participate in that. And it really made a difference, you know. Like, I'd still have low moments, but generally, you know, there was a lot of people around. My manager at the time, Kevin Albrecht, was in my hospital room every day of treatment. And he never left my side. And I'll always remember that with incredible gratitude, you know. And I remember when I was in the hospital the first week of chemo, it happened to be the week of the Masters. And so I got to watch Tiger Woods win the Masters. I didn't miss one minute of the coverage, which I've never been able to do in my life, you know, because I'm touring and I'm busy and I'm doing a lot of things. And there's a lot of memories that were attached to that time. I had a laptop and I was trying to figure out how to use it, you know, and back then the operating systems weren't as they were now, you know, and it was just a nightmare to kind of get these things worked out. But, you know, Christy Yamaguchi came to visit me. Katya Gordieva flew from Europe straight to me in Denver just to spend a day, you know, just an afternoon to make sure that, you know, she was there to support. And I had good people around me. Eileen Honan, who was a figure skating champion from the 50s and 60s, she would bring me homemade chicken soup all the time, which was amazing. And so there was, I look back on the really great memories and all of that. And there were a couple vivid ones that were, low spots, but I was always able to get through those. After round three of four, it's 5 days of 8-hour infusions and then 16 days off, and then 5 days of 8 hours infusions and 16 days off. And it's, it just feels like gallons of chemo are going through your body at all times, and all the hydration. After round three, I just, my body, my life, everything had changed so drastically that I just wanted to quit. And I didn't really care if the cancer won at that point. And a friend of mine just looked at me and he just was smiling and laughing. And I go, "What's so funny?" And he goes, "Well, how many rounds do you have left?" I go, "One." And we both started to laugh. I really wanted a pity party, but he wasn't going to give it to me. And I go, "One." And he goes, "Yeah, you got that." I go, "Yeah."
Well, it's just so clear how you've grasped to the positives when they're there. I think, that's very obvious in hearing you talk about everything you've gone through, is finding those positives. And you've done that in more than just your own life. You've become really an incredible activist in supporting research with your Scott Hamilton Cares Foundation. And you've written several books. I want to talk about your most recent one, which is focused on kids. It's called Fritzy Finds a Hat. And I'm just curious how that came about, the idea of kind of tying that, explaining cancer to kids, and then how the book kind of came together, because I think it's a really interesting idea.
Well, I talk about my mom, the way she told us that she had cancer. It really struck a chord with Mary Coffin from the Moffitt Cancer Center. And so she's the one that kind of brought this whole idea of a children's book forward, and she did a lot of the research, and she was kind of like the backbone of all of it. And then, we got the story and we did all of that, and then it came time to find an illustrator. And I remember, anytime I've been around Brad Paisley, there's art everywhere. He just loves, it's almost like therapy for him. I think it's just, He's always painting, he's always creating, he's always like everything just comes away out of it, whether it be music or whatever, painting or whatever. I mean, Brad's really, and his kids are also very much in it as well. And so I went over to his house and I said, "Hey, I'm doing this children's book. Do you want to do the illustrations?" And he said, "Sure." I'm like, "Okay." Well, I had this whole pitch.
You had to put the pitch back in your pocket. Yeah.
I'm not going to, now all I can do now is mess it up. Right. So he and his two sons, Huck and Jasper, worked together to do the hat illustrations. And then we brought in Bill Kersey to do kind of the artistic elements to bring the book, kind of together as a whole. And Carrie Morgan, who is the executive director of the CARES Foundation, she was sort of the facilitator to make sure that everything got done exactly the way it needed to be done. And we had a great book agent who really did a great job of getting it out in front of as many people as possible. I mean, just the first printing, Target ordered 5,000 copies and gave it end cap space. So it was an important book because, again, you're a parent, you've got little kids. There are statistics that show that a certain percentage, and it's healthy percentage of people in that age, is going to be diagnosed with cancer. How do you tell your children, and how do you, make it so that they can take control of their part of it, And so in this story, Fritzy's mom, who's basically my mom, if you look, the illustrations, originally were June Cleaver. And then I realized, it's, going back to the kind of prototypical housewife of the 60s, I'm always dressed to the nines. And I go, no, my mom was a little round and she was a little short, And so they drew her. And it was really great. The way that she told us was basically the way that Fritzy was told by his mom that she had cancer. And so it was up to him now to figure out how he could best participate in her journey. And he realized that she was going to need a hat, on her days of treatment. And because she told him that maybe some of the medicine would make her hair fall out. And he was like, okay, I'm going to make her the perfect, I'm going to get her the perfect hat. And so it's more than cancer. It's kind of like teaching children that, they can help their parents. it's giving them that muscle in their psyches where they can kind of say, wow, my mom or dad is up against it. Like, what can I do to help them? Like, I have power. I have the power to help them in these, you know, when they need my help, I can do that. Even at any age, I can do that. So that what I thought was really a powerful lesson. But, you know, to my knowledge, there hadn't been anything like it to help parents talk to their children about cancer. And one interviewer in New York, when we were doing the you know, kind of the book media, he said it's really a beautiful, gentle place to land for children. And I thought, wow, that's the best way I've ever heard it put. It's a beautiful, gentle way to talk to your kids about cancer. It's a soft place for them to land. And I thought, well, then we've done our job. If that's how, you know, people outside our little bubble of, you know, people producing this book see it, then that really gave me permission to know that we did a really good job.
Yeah, I just thought it was a very interesting and original idea and very well put together. So I'd encourage people who have kids to check that out. Now, Scott, you're a busy man. You have a lot going on. You're an author. You have lots to do, but you also occasionally are honored. And last year, you know, we have the Robin Roberts Thrivership Fund here at the V Foundation. Yeah. It focuses on funding research to improve the lives of cancer survivors, you know, after their cancer journey. Last year, you received the Thriver of the Year Award from Robin at her event in New York. You know, how cool is that to be recognized by someone who's as passionate as Robin is, as you know, about this?
Oh, I adore Robin. And, you know, I was the first one.
That's right.
I'm thinking, wow. You know, with my CARES Foundation, we've been working with the V Foundation since we launched as an independent foundation. For 15 years, I was with the Cleveland Clinic and working with them to kind of build up a lot of their patient support programs, like Fourth Angel Mentoring Program, where we pair newly diagnosed patients with survivors, and the chemocare.com website, where it's everything you need to know about chemotherapy and eighth grade English and Spanish. Nothing like that had existed to that point. And so we funded a lot of research there. And so when we stepped out nationally, we built a strong alliance. You know, the A in CARES is alliance. CARES stands for the Cancer Alliance for Research, Education, and Survivorship. And the survivorship component was one that I think really allowed for them to kind of look at it and go, wow, that's really cool. That's part. It wasn't always just about funding research. It was about really serving the cancer community in a really broad way. Now, in this independent inception of CARES, we're purely research. But Robin, it was funny, when Mandisa did that Overcomer video, Robin and I were in that. And so I think that probably put me on Robin's heart. And so they said, we want to do a Thrivership Award. They nominated me, and it was yes. And so the festivities in New York were amazing. It was a great event. It's like when they do this event next year, I pray that we're able to do events again soon. It was really a wonderful evening of celebrating life and celebrating all that's being done to extend lives for people that have been affected by cancer, and you know, with the hopes that we are headed towards a cure. But the whole idea of thrivership is, you know, when we look at the publicist for cancer treatment, you know, it's got a pretty rough, you know, image. You know, you're going to suffer, you're going to lose your hair, you're going to, you know, bloat up, you're going to be sick, you're going to this, you're going to all those things that come with traditional treatments for cancer. It's kind of like, why would I want to do that? You know? And right. So yeah. The whole idea of thrivership is to really get behind developing research on many different tiers, right? To make sure that when people fight their cancer, that they're not diminishing their lives afterward, that they can look at this specific period of time as, this is my time to deal with my cancer, but I'm, from here on out, I get stronger, I'll get better, and I'll be able to get back to where I was before or beyond it, with this newfound strength and power that I've displayed in beating my cancer. But it's about research headed in a direction, and that's CARES' entire platform, is treat the cancer and spare the patient harm. Why are we hurting people while we're, and no, that's the best we've been able to do, but we've come so far that are we really still doing this? You know, no, we need to develop treatments that purely go after the cancer cell exclusively and leave the rest of the body alone. And we've got to be able to, you know, uplift immunotherapy, which is unleashing our own immune system against the cancer, and targeted therapies that really only go after that specific cell type and that specific protein that is in that cancer cell, just to leave the rest of the body alone. And it's about proton therapy instead of traditional radiation, which is very, very precise. And there's no bathe through radiation that is with traditional radiation. You know, it's the nature of the beam with X-ray and photon traditional radiation is it releases its power on the cancer and then it goes into the body until it runs out of energy. Where proton therapy is a particle. They take the proton out of a hydrogen atom, spin it at 2/3 the speed of light, and stop it inside the tumor where the radiation is released, specifically in the very precise area of the tumor itself, and there's no bathe through radiation. So anything that will treat the cancer and spare the patient harm allows for thrivership, right? It allows for people to get back to life without all the collateral damage, without all the, you know, long lasting effects, or, you know, like after effects or late effects of chemotherapy. I was told when I got through my chemo, it's like, you know, you're going to be fine. You're going to be great. You can build and you're going to be okay. 20 years, maybe 20 years, you got to really start looking at some things specifically due to the chemotherapy breaking down your body's ability to regenerate at a certain level. So, you know, I'm 23 years past and I'm still basically living my life on my own terms. And I always joke that I've never been this old before, so I have nothing to compare it to. But, you know, I'm enjoying that too, because, you know, my mom, she had a 2.5 year battle, I guess, 2 years, 2 months. Man, I'm 23 years alive. So, you know, there's a lot of good things going on, and cancer research is a great investment, not only in your future, but in your children, grandchildren, great grandchildren's futures. That cancer is not going away, but how we treat it can be something that truly, truly revolutionizes it from being, you know, in many cases, a death sentence to being something that, you know, it's just, yeah, it's like any other illness, and my body will take care of it and I'll get back to life.
And as we continue to fund more research that will, you know, those treatments you talk about will hopefully become more and more common, and they'll find new ones that continue to work better. And we can fund all that research because we have people like you, Scott, who are out there, you know, spending your time and raising money and spreading awareness about how important this is. So we certainly thank you for all that you do for cancer research and the V Foundation through your CARES Foundation. We're lucky to have you as an ambassador of the V Foundation and someone who we know is fighting the good fight every day. So thank you, Scott. We really appreciate you coming on and talking with us for a little while today to share your story.
Well, it's me that is thanking you, because, you know, platforms like this really educate and enlighten people to know that they can participate in this. And it's not, you know, like cancer treatment is, or cancer research is expensive, but if you spread it out, like Danny Thomas said, I'd rather get a dollar from a million people than $1 million from one person, because more people get involved. And I go, well, I'm okay with either. You know, we'll, I just want to get it done, right? But the V Foundation has been extraordinary of really leveraging relationships in order to build a foundation that is able to do remarkable things. And for us to, you know, work independently alongside of them and partner with them in so much research, you know, all ships rise. You know, if we take half of a research grant, you know, that gives them the ability to, invest in something else. And we can be specific to our, you know, our calling, and they can, you know, continue to be broaden their net. And you know, Susan Braun is a spectacular leader. It's just amazing, you know, what's been built and how she has been a phenomenal leader and CEO, and we just couldn't be more proud of the relationship and the successes we've had already, and there'll be a lot more to brag about in the future, I know.
No question about that. Scott Hamilton, thank you so much for joining us, and we will talk to you again soon, hopefully.
Thank you so much, Mick.
Well, that's it for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Scott. Please make sure to subscribe to the Voices for Victory podcast wherever you listen so you never miss an episode. And if you can toss us a 5-star review, even better. To learn more about the V Foundation for Cancer Research, visit v.org or follow the foundation on social media at the V Foundation. Until next time.
To me, there are three things we all should do every day. We do this every day of our life. You're going to have, what a wonderful, number one is laugh. You should laugh every day. Number two is think. You should spend some time in thought. And number three is you should have your emotions moved to tears. Could be happiness or joy. But think about it. If you laugh, you think, and you cry, that's a full day. That's a heck of a day.